Welcome to WeAreTechnology.com's User Friendly 2.0 with host Bill Sickens, Technology Architect.
And this is User Friendly 2.0. I am your host, Bill Sickens. Bill Gretchen, welcome to this week's show.
Hello there.
So let's jump straight into the news, and it's going to be our news. We're going to be doing something a little bit different for the next couple of weeks. And what we've got set up here is that we have looked back at a couple of our technology episodes from the last couple of years and picked out a few with topics that are still relevant today. So we're going to be re-airing that episode this week, next week, and the week after, the three different ones, of course. And then after Halloween, we're going to come back and do follow-ups on all three of those episodes to see what has changed between when this was recorded 2-3 years ago and now. So what do you guys think about all this?
Should be fun.
Okay, cool. I hope it is.
Yeah.
So this first one, we are going to be looking at Boston Dynamics and robot dogs. This was originally recorded last year.
And I like robot dogs.
Would have been last fall, so right about a year ago now. And it's going to be interesting to see where this technology has progressed. So with no further ado, let's go ahead and drop in. We are going to be keeping the news and everything else. So some of the news is probably going to be a little bit dated. So it's going to be kind of fun to look at that and see what really has changed on that front too. And this is User Friendly 2.0. Welcome to this week's show. We got a lot of stuff for you. In our second segment, we're actually going to be doing two great interviews, and I invite you to stick around for that because we're getting some wonderful guests and just a lot of vast, you know, topics of things. And Gretchen, I think you'll appreciate this. We love having all the authors on the show. It's been really cool.
Yeah, it has been a lot of fun.
So I think we're learning the process, by the way, that all these people have gone through with CyberHawk, and it's like, it is just, it's not an easy thing to do. It's very fulfilling, but, you know.
Yeah.
So, we just absolutely love to hear the stories. Anyway, so that's coming up in the second segment, and let's go ahead and jump into the news and see what we got.
Well, apparently, Ukraine is getting ready to unleash a swarm of robot dogs.
Yes. And so, you know, we've seen some videos of, like, you know, Spot, and who's a robot dog that's been in the news and that kind of thing from Boston Dynamics and some different things. But these kind of robots are being made for military use. And in Ukraine, they are having personnel problems, a shortage of people. And on top of that, even if they weren't, you really don't want your warriors, you know, to be in harm's way any more than they have to. So these kind of things actually make a lot of sense. The robot dogs will be used to detect landmines, go on reconnaissance missions, and scope out the enemy in hostile territory. They also can carry weapons and ammunition and do other things.
They look so spooky.
Yeah, yeah. In fact, we'll throw a picture of that up on our social media so you can see it. But, you know, I don't know. These are programmed pretty well. One of the journalists is looking at one of the dogs that was named Bad One. There's a name for a dog, right? And he walked up to it, and the dog crouched and ran and did all the normal stuff like a regular flesh and blood dog would do. But I think the only negative thing would be is if somehow the programming got screwed up and they didn't know who the enemy was. But I think they've kind of worked through that enough to where this is going to be very, very helpful. And the big thing about it is the bastards keep putting mines down everywhere, and it's extremely dangerous. And, you know, that type of a thing, since World War II had a lot of that, they're still finding mines in Germany and places like that, France and so on. Oh. And they can be very dangerous years later. So this is something that's really going to have to be dealt with.
I think this is like Vietnam has something similar where they have.
Yeah. Yeah.
In Cambodia.
This stuff cleaned up can be.
Yeah.
So anyway, the robot dog has a runtime of 2 hours. An onboard thermal imaging system, and a kill switch that erases all of the data if the robot would fall into the hands of the Russians. So, interesting little item. I'm going to be curious to see how this goes, you know. The bottom line of this is it just goes to show how military forces will use and push technology to their limit in order to gain battlefield advantage, even if the results look like they came out of the Terminator movies. And most of what I've seen in AI is not like this. This is kind of a little closer maybe than some of the other stuff.
Yeah, I agree.
Speaking along lines of animals, streaming media is going to the chickens.
So if I was to ask you the question, what would be the most unlikely company you would think that's going to launch a streaming media channel? Would Chick-fil-A be one of the ones that would come up as something you wouldn't expect?
No, yeah. I would not expect that.
So, well, according to Deadline, they are launching a service later this year. And they're actually putting together money, actually $400,000 for unscripted series that they're doing as custom productions. And this is all like family-friendly stuff to go along with the restaurant. And the projects include a family-friendly game show, among other things. So it's going to be interesting to see where this goes. Now, the one question I have to ask is this going to be available on Sunday, you know, because they close the restaurants for Sunday.
Oh, yeah.
So can you stream on Sunday or? So anyway, so yeah, the streaming media field is very saturated, and the big boys like Netflix and Disney Plus and so on have been kind of regrouping to make sure that they actually still can make money off of it. But this could be a very unique thing, because I think especially for people that would like something they know is family friendly, it actually might make sense. But it just seems like, you know, can I get, you know, a streaming media service with my chicken? Somehow those two things just don't go together for me.
Yeah, it's going to be curious to see what kind of advertising is on this streaming media. Is it all
chicken?
This is
true. This is true. Yeah, really.
Okay. Oh, my goodness. I am so very shocked. And let me hold up my sarcasm sign. The Acolyte has been canceled.
So I want to thank our listeners, because we got no less than 109 emails just making sure we knew this happened. For anybody that hasn't heard about this, The Acolyte is a series that came out earlier this year. And Gretchen, go ahead and give us your unbiased opinion.
Oh, I don't think I'll be able to give you an unbiased opinion. You know what I mean? I'm like, oh my goodness. I'm just happy it's no longer going to be canon.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just, yeah. And that's where they're going. You know, it's an interesting thing with this too, is because, you know, anything that's produced pretty much, there's going to be likers and there's going to be haters. I mean, that's just normal. And when you look at things where you have something where even the people that I know that normally would love anything Star Wars really didn't care for this, it is something that it's unusual to see that many people kind of unilaterally together.
Bill, it's not Star Wars.
Yeah.
It's kind of like having Star Trek Next Generation. You have Picard and everybody on the set, and then you start throwing pies and having clowns running around. If you just destroy the genre and ignore the storyline and everything that's been set up that people love, it's just not right. If they wanted to tell a story like what they told that shouldn't have been Star Wars, they should have had the guts to do their own thing.
Yeah.
It's a lot of work to invent your own universe. Every writer that we've had on this show will tell you that. And destroying somebody else's universe it's not cool.
It's interesting too on this, because if you look back at kind of where this is going, I mean, Disney's had some hits, Mandalorian, everybody loves, not everybody, but you know, it's generally something that most like, and some of the other series, Bad Batch, I know I really like. And you know, so a lot of it's been good. But it's also been kind of rocky in some ways with the Star Wars fans. So, you know, just to kind of dive into this a little bit further, you talk about it not being canon. So Disney bought Star Wars about 10 years ago now. So that's when that happened. And right when they did it, they basically took everything and made it Legends instead of canon. And what that means is that you have a setup for the storyline of what things should be based on, I guess would be the best way to put it. Gretchen, Bill, maybe you can explain canon a little better.
Yeah, I guess basically canon is the rules of the universe and the accepted storylines. Like Darth Vader is not going to be running around in a pink costume wearing a tutu. He's supposed to be a scary, damaged hero. A fallen hero. That's what he's supposed to be. And when you go and change things so dramatically, that changes the canon. And it's not what the fans wanted. You know what I mean?
And that's where this went. So after they acquired Lucasfilm, Disney announced that almost all Star Wars material outside of the six movies and the Clone Wars was to be reclassified as canons. So in other words, they made books, video games, source books, and so on, non-canon in one fell swoop. Now, this all circles back to The Acolyte, because in addition to canceling or not doing a second season, they've decided to remove it from canon. In fact, I think they already have. So,
To tell you the truth, I'd like to see them remove some of the High Republic stuff from canon.
Yeah. Oh, there's
that
other
stuff
things.
That stuff is dreadful.
But
you know, and people will get angry at Disney. Disney did a beautiful job with Rebels.
Yeah.
It was a really nice series. Good acting, good storytelling, nice artwork, great music. There wasn't anything to be upset about. A Star Wars fan can love Rebels and Bad Batch and so forth. But this other stuff, it's not Star Wars.
Yeah. And it's also in a way that it was presented to. I think a lot of just so everybody knows, I have not seen The Acolyte. What happened was, is when it came out, I was going to watch it like everybody else. And then everybody that I talked to about it, including my garrison and my cosplay, Star Wars cosplay group, is like, you just don't want to. And it seems to be kind of the general thing. Now, there are people out there that like this, I think. I just haven't been able to find a lot of information on that, but it's not like 100% of people hate it. But at the end of the day, it definitely does go to show that you need to take into consideration your fans. It doesn't matter what you're doing. If you have a fan base, you probably want to do stuff that the fans are going to like, and you certainly don't want to do stuff that they're going to hate. I mean, you know, even when George Lucas was running this, some of the characters and stuff were a little bit, the fans were a little bit controversial, Jar Jar Binks being one. But at the end of the day, it made sense for that character to be in the movie, in my opinion, because it filled a specific role. Now,
he did have a role.
He was a little maybe too goofy, but,
But you had to have this character that was naive and foolish, who would actually allow Palpatine and Mos Eisley to talk him into suggesting this change in law.
Yeah.
Padme would have never have done it. She was too smart.
And it's just, you know, but the other side of it is when changing things too, I think you have to think things through and you have to think ahead. I still, for the life of me, in the last Star Wars movie, cannot figure out how a character like Palpatine would ever end up having a kid.
The
backstory of that character just does not support something like that in any capacity. And then it also kind of came out of nowhere, you know? So
it wasn't
some
part
of these
the
things
original
are
canon.
Important and, I'm sorry?
Well, it wasn't part of the original canon. And if you talk to people who read a lot of the books, there was a story set up. Luke and Leia, Luke got married to Mara Jade and had a child. Leia got married to Han Solo and they had three kids. And Han Solo and Leia were happily married.
Right.
They destroyed that. So all of a sudden, the poor guy can't get the princess. What happened there? You know, why did that happen?
These things don't make sense. Well, I got to ask you a question then. Just to kind of make all of this work in canon as a, you know, cosplayer that does the Palpatine character. What would my line be? I am your father. Just do it. I mean, that has a bad connotation to it, I think. Anyway, not that we have an opinion on this, and it is all opinion, you know, but such as it is. All right, what else do we have in the news?
Well, Chrome security flaw under active exploitation.
Yes.
That doesn't
sound
like fun.
So it's called CVE-2024-7965, so everybody remember that. There will be a test.
Okay.
Basically, at the end of the day, just make sure your Chrome is updated. What this is, and it's something that happens... we've seen it in the past, is that we have a situation where they can execute code and do other things through malicious websites and take control of a user's browser, computer, getting to private information and so on. Not something you want to have happen, but certainly in office and professional environments, you also end up with a situation where the bad guys could get into networks and things like that. And that leads to ransomware and stolen information and all of that. So again, it's one of these type of situations. Just make sure your software is up to date on that. They have released a patch and it looks like the patch has fixed it, I think. So there you are.
Let's hope so. Twitter Blue, a train wreck.
Yeah.
What's that about?
Okay. So for anybody that doesn't remember this, when Musk took over Twitter, one of the first things that was done is the whole controversy over the check marks, the blue check marks.
Yeah.
And what that was a situation where instead of having to be authenticated, which personally speaking, I think the process they used prior to that was way too involved. You know, it was like, even if you should be authenticated, you a lot of times couldn't get it. But then they flipped it from, well, pay $8 a month and you'll get a check mark. It doesn't matter who you are. Mm-hmm. And I remember during that era, I would log on one because I had the legitimate check mark originally. And one day it would be there and then they weren't going to have it anymore unless we paid for it, which I wasn't going to do. And then it would come back and then it would go away. And this situation turned out to be the first in a long series of what in a lot of people's opinions were some very bad decisions that have kind of really screwed up this social media platform. And there's a book coming out on this called Character Limit, How Elon Musk Destroyed Twitter. So you get an idea of what this book is probably about by the title. Two that are in the know that talk about some of these different things. And one of the comments that was made is as soon as this came out, Musk wanted them to turn off the feature. But it's very difficult to do that in an environment like this. You put it in, you can't, you know, just really take it back out again. And what's come out of this thing is a number of very strange decisions that has caused a lot of the advertisers to leave Twitter, now X, right? And It's, you know, causing a lot of problems. So I think what this led into is the amount that was paid by Musk and associates for Twitter was $44 billion with a B. Okay. Mm-hmm. And that's a lot of money, especially for something that's being run in a way that's not making it back anymore. The Twitter was taken private, and I'm kind of glad it was. I owned stock in it at the time, and I'm glad that I don't now. But it's just a situation, and where this train wreck thing comes from is this is a quote from one of the workers that worked on Twitter Blue that said it was such an obvious train wreck that the main job of everybody on the team was to make sure it was the safest train wreck possible. So that was one of the most positive comments they could find about it. So,
oh my, you know, it's weird. When we first started the show, Twitter was fun. It was fun to post photos from comic cons and you could interact with people and you could share the hashtags and it was fun. And
yeah,
then it stopped being fun with the politics and then it just seemed to get worse and worse. So it's been a sad thing for me, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. It really has. I agree with you because I used to enjoy posting, you know, when we'd go to cosplay and stuff, you could throw pictures up and that type of a thing. And it was a lot of fun to do, but it's come to a situation now where there is so much politic on it from both sides of the coin that it's like there isn't a way to really navigate that and you know, be there. Even our own show had to leave because of these kind of problems. And it, you know, it's created a situation where it is really too bad because it was something that a lot of people really liked. But, you know, I don't know. And then the other thing of it is there's a lot of kind of a bad karma feeling because after this all happened, a good portion of the people that had worked for Twitter for a very long time were laid off, you know, very bluntly. And then they were asked to come back a few weeks later in some cases. And it's just been kind of this flipping back and forth thing. There's been stories of engineers that stayed with the company that were forced to sleep in their offices and stuff to meet deadlines that were unrealistic in their opinion, which that sounds like it would be, and other things. Also, there's claims that the rent at the office in San Francisco wasn't paid. I mean, you know, so stuff like that. And it's just kind of one of those things that's ended up in a place. I just wanted to talk about this a little bit because this is the information that's coming out in that book. And I think we're going to have the authors on and probably later this year to talk about this a little more when it gets out. But the thing of it is we've started to be asked some questions from our listeners that are very legitimate because we've left the platform. And like a lot of people, it's not just us. It's been a situation where anything that you would do as a business on something like that is obviously to usually help your business. So In the case of user-friendly, we wanted our listeners to know what was going on, you know, to post some things to the pictures, because this is a radio show, so sometimes you'd like to be able to show things and whatnot. And there's just no way to good way to do it anymore. So we're still on Facebook. We're also on LinkedIn. And I think we might be doing something with Instagram. At least we're talking about it, to have the photo capability again. But it is interesting to see where this goes. Now, I will say this. I hope somehow that they get this, or somebody else comes up with an idea like Twitter, because in its early days, it was, you know, it was very fun. And one of the other big concerns I know too with the whole Twitter Blue fiasco is because you can fake that you're other people. We just don't want to, you know, get in the middle of that. One of the most egregious ones of this was somebody that said they were Nintendo, or they got the blue check mark, and they put an image up of Super Mario giving everybody the finger. I don't think that was an official Nintendo publication, but you couldn't tell. So anyway, onward and upward, but that's what's going on, and that seems to be where this is at.
Yeah, Amazon to launch a new version of Alexa in October.
So it's interesting, this seems to be a little bit behind the times with generative AI showing up everywhere else that this hasn't. But this is something that's coming up, good, bad, or indifferent. The Alexa that we know now is going to remain around, but there is going to be a subscription-based upgrade. They're talking about somewhere around $10 a month that will bring a generative AI version. Now, from what I'm seeing about this, it actually looks like something that would be kind of cool. You can carry on a normal conversation, things like that. It's capable of doing those type of things, but it is going to not be free. And I think part of this is that Amazon's big concern about all of this has been the fact that they have had a very hard time monetizing the whole smart speaker thing. Now, you buy the equipment, and I'm not feeling sorry for Amazon. They've made a lot of money off of selling the Echoes and other things that go along with this. But like everything else, they'd love to see something with reoccurring income. So this is going to be an attempt at it. Now, whether or not that works out and people will pay, I don't know. But I do think the technology that they're planning to launch here, which, by the way, is about a year late from when they originally announced it, is something that could be really cool. So we'll see what it ends up being, if it actually really does come out this fall, and we'll certainly review it. And if it works the way it will, maybe we'll have her as a guest on our show. We'll see.
Well,
the AI, that is.
Yes, I figured as much.
All right, stay with us for the next segment. We've got two great interviews coming up. This is User Friendly 2.0. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is User Friendly 2.0. We've got two great interviews coming up here in just a second. Our first one is going to be an author that has a really cool book that she has put out, Kendi Pearson. And the book is When the Mountains Wept. Very interesting novel. And I know when we were talking with her to do the interview, there was a lot of, it sounded like something that was really interesting to read. It's set in a historic setting and so on. So I'll let her go ahead and get into that. With no further ado, let's go to our interview. Joining us now, guest Kendi Pearson. Kendi, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me, Bill.
So it's great to have you here. And I know you're a writer, and we're going to talk about that a little bit. So let's dive right in. What got you started in your writing career?
What got me started? Well, it was Plan B, kind of. Many years I taught in private Christian high schools. And that was just something I dearly loved it. Never had a morning where I hated getting up and going to work like so many jobs. And I have a hereditary degenerative hearing impairment. And first time I failed my test was when I was 18 years old, you know, back in the old days where they used to give hearing tests every year in school, and got hearing aids when I was 30. Anyway, it got to the point where I couldn't handle a classroom full of teenagers. If you've ever had a teenager, they don't look at you when they talk. They cover their mouths. It just got to be too much. And so then I kind of backed off and I thought, this is crazy. This is stressful. I could be better. I can't do more. And so I kind of hung out for a couple years, did a little subbing, which was also not good. And I'm like, what am I supposed to do? And I was, I'm a musician and I teach music. And I was asked to be on a worship team at a big Christian writers conference. And I went there just to do the music gig. And I attended a whole bunch of the writers workshops. And just a light bulb went on. And I thought, I can do this. This is something I want to do. And so I started with the process that many writers do. I started writing freelance. I got the market guides out for the writer's market guides, and I started submitting stories, learning the do's and don'ts of, you know, how to write for publication, and sold 200 articles in my first year and a half. And I was doing really well. And I thought, well, let me do something that else. I started writing children's books because at the time my grandkids were toddlers. And that was a lot of fun. I won awards right out of the gate. And I'm like, wow, this is really cool. I'm going to write what I love to read. And that's historical fiction. And I immediately, with my first book, my first pitch, my first conference, I got an agent who was this one of the top agents. And I'm like, wow, this is fun. I've got this made. And she said, keep writing, keep writing. I wrote book 2 in the series. I wrote book 3 in the series. I wrote book 1 of the next series, which was totally different, historical and a whole different setting. And 5 years went by, and all I heard was, I went to the pub board over and over and over, and I kept hearing, Civil War isn't selling. Civil War isn't selling. Even though I had so many friends who loved Civil War, and I talked to so many other authors, and I rubbed shoulders with the greats in my genre because of the literary agency I was with. And so that was providence. That was wonderful that I had that experience. And there I sat after 5 years and nothing happened. I've got 4 novels and 7 picture books under my belt and 6 awards. And I don't know what to do next. And there's something I never wanted to do. Never, ever did I want to self-publish, because I just knew how much work it was, because I don't know how to do anything halfway. So. Yeah. Anyway, that kind of led me to the point where, you know, these books are sitting around. They just got to get out there. I want to be fruitful. I want those books to get out there. So, that's the beginning of another journey.
I hear you. And that's actually where I was going to go with this. Your brand is Heart of History. So tell us a little bit about that.
Well, obviously, right off the bat, they're really pounding, you need a brand, you need a brand, you need a brand. And I thought, well, as a former history teacher, having taught, you know, really difficult things in history, and 1 year I had six sections of history, grades 9 through 12, and I taught the Civil War in 4 of them. And there was just so much there that's unpleasant, and so much there that people don't know. And then I found out that there is a lot of the history before 1870 in the United States that's not taught in the public schools anymore. And I'm thinking, well, you know what? Somebody has to point out there's these things that nobody's talking about, that nobody's ever learned about. And as a writer, the first thing you learn is don't do what exactly has already been done. It's been done. Publishers will turn their nose up in an instant. That's been done. That's been done. And you're putting a proposal together and you're coming up with comps, and you want to say, my book is different in this way. And so Heart of History is about those things in history that are kind of obscure, that the average person doesn't know about, but they're important. And the way I write, you know, there's basically two ways to write historical fiction. You can write a story, let's just say a love story or an adventure story, and then you can plug that story into any era and make that story come to life, right? Or you can take the setting and take all those factual things in the setting and weave them into a story and make it very credible. A lot of the comments I've heard about my books is that you feel like you're right there. And that's the way I write. So I pull things from the heart of history that are unique and different. This book right now, I know if I hold it up as a title backwards, but
no, I don't think they'll see that on the air, but
it takes place in West Virginia. And I have a gal she connected with me on my Facebook author page, and she's in West Virginia. She was born and raised there. Her mom and dad have been there forever, you know, and all the generations. She was telling me about it. She said, and I learned stuff I never knew. I never knew. And I thought, that is a big compliment that the history teacher in me is victorious. So, yeah, that's the heart of history. It's I'm digging things up from the heart of history.
I got a question for you. Why history? What drew you to that topic?
I don't know if I've ever thought about that. First of all, part of it was raising three boys who absolutely loved everything history and military, and watching everything you can think of, you know, the Pacific and all of these historical renditions and documentaries. My husband loves documentaries. So I basically been watching all that stuff for such a long time. And my dad was a World War II vet and a Korean vet. And I was very much into those things when I was teaching them. And so I really developed a love of history as I got even older. I don't think I would have ever read a book like this when I was in my 20s. When I was in college, I don't think so. I would have read contemporary stuff. But no, history, you know, the Santayana quote, if we don't learn from the mistakes of others, we're destined to repeat it. You know, we've got to look at history and what has happened, because human beings are the same. They're the same today as they were then, but the choices we make and the reasons we make them, all we have to do is look at that roadmap behind us and see where have we come from, you know, let that help guide us and make decisions. I just feel like it's an important part of today. History is very integral to today.
You know, and you hit the nail on the head, because I know that that's one thing, is a lot of stuff isn't taught in the schools anymore. And it's nice to have the opportunity in kind of a fun way, you know, to be able to get onto this stuff. So your most recent novel, When the Mountains Wept, which is what you tried to show us there earlier, and we'll put it in our social media so that our listeners can actually see it. But go ahead and tell us a little bit about that.
Well, this book is it's about a wealthy plantation, Virginia plantation owner's son, who is running from his legacy. He's trying to pay penance for his past. He wants to forget his past. And he becomes a small town doctor in Charleston, soon to be, in a couple years, West Virginia. Okay. So a lot of people don't realize Virginia, it used to be all Virginia. It became West Virginia split halfway through the war. They joined with the Union, and Virginia seceded with the Confederacy. So, anyway, so it's his story, and it's mingled with the story of a farm family in Gully Bridge, West Virginia, who find themselves in a horrendous situation. The war is right at their front door. It's right there, right there. They've got a graveyard in their pasture that's got dead from the north and the south. Their barn is commandeered by my hero as a hospital. And it just basically is showing all of the tragedies that happened to the people as they were living in the middle of the cauldron, where, you know, it was truly neighbor against neighbor, brother against brother. It was born out of me doing a tremendous amount of research and reading story after story after story of things that really, really happened. And so in the back of my book, I point out a lot of the things that really did happen that I read about. Others were inspired by stories that I read about. And one of the things when you're writing a novel, you need conflict. You need a lot of conflict. It's got to be there. And so you learn that you just keep piling on the problems. You pile them on and pile them on and pile them on. And then you've got to find a way for your hero to dig their way out. So it is a story about a gal who wants to preserve her legacy, save her farm, because it's being taken over by bushwhackers, and it's about a man who's trying to pay penance for his past and get away from all of that. He was asked to join the Confederacy, a very prestigious position as a doctor, to the Kanawha riflemen there in Charleston, Virginia, and he turned it down and he joined the Union as a regimental surgeon. So there's a tremendous amount of story going on there. It's so hard to talk about it without giving anything away, but
yeah.
No, I mean, that's amazing. Before we started the interview, we were talking a little bit, and this is one I'm going to order and read. It's a topic I'd like. And I think just after this conversation now, I'm really looking forward to that. And I mean, that's amazing. So we have the Amazon link, which we'll share on our social media. But do you have any other website or anything you'd like to give our listeners where they can get more information?
They can go to kendipearson.com.
Okay. That's easy.
Yeah. And also on Goodreads, I'm on Goodreads. So if you're on there, I have an author profile on there.
Okay. So, all right. So Goodreads or, and again, we've got all that out on our social media. So if you're driving right now, don't try to write this down. That would be dangerous. Just go to our userfriendly.show. You can look it up there and get that website and get the order link, because I think this sounds like something really interesting. Gretchen, did you have any other questions?
No.
All right. Anything else you would like to tell us?
I can't think of anything right now. Book 2 is coming out in the fall.
Okay.
So I over and over, I've heard my reviews. They're like, I can't wait for the next book to come out. I do put the first chapter of it in the back of this book.
That's kind of cool. Talk about a tease.
Yeah. I think that's why everybody's commenting, I can't wait for the next book to come out.
But that is actually a very good idea.
They do that with a lot of the Star Wars stuff.
I love
stuff,
it. So. Yeah. I do love it when that happens with series, and it just gives you a little taste of what's coming. And I've also had a lot of my readers make suggestions of what they would like to see happen in future books. That's fun.
Yeah, that's a fun part of being able to publish now, is that you can get feedback from your readers. And, that's a fairly new thing. It wasn't like that for most of history, as you know. So,
yes.
I think we're in a time where if we use things wisely, we can actually accomplish a lot. So
there is, most of my friends are traditionally published with big houses, and I am actually tasting, I started my own press, Pear Blossom Books, and I have 2 imprints going with that. It's only published 1 book so far, but there's a lot of freedom and a lot of control. Yes, decision overload, but it's it's a wonderfully satisfying feeling to have that kind of input on what you're doing when it's so dear to your heart sometimes.
All right, Kendi Pearson, When the Mountains Wept. Again, we're going to put the links in our social media at userfriendly.show. Check it out. This looks like an incredible book. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Definitely pick a copy of that up. It is available on Amazon and other places. Our next interview, I'm just going to bleed into it. This is a high-tech problem solver. Want to know what we're talking about? Here we go. Joining us now, guest Arno Lucas. Arno, welcome to User Friendly.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
So instead of me trying to bumble my way through your background here, which is somewhat extensive, why don't I just start with, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and what you're doing?
Sure. So as you can hear from my voice, I'm actually French originally. But I've spent more time in the U.S. than in France. First 8 years in Texas doing startups, and then moved to Boston area, where I've done other companies like Iron Mountain, TripAdvisor, Wayfair. And I'm currently CTO at Wondo, which is a small startup in travel and current transportation. So my career has always been about leading kind of high growth, forward thinking, technology first kind of B2C organizations. And really look at what we're trying to do for the customer, right? Because I strongly believe on my Wayfair days that if you solve problems for the customers, if you effectively give them what they need and how they need it, then money will come effectively. They will be more than happy to pay for it. So that's kind of my philosophy. I also care a lot about companies being people first and setting people for success, making sure that they have the right level of ownership, that are empowered to deliver impact based on that ownership. So that's a little bit about me and creating this organization to definitely deliver the right business impact.
So tell us how you would work with your clients. How does that look?
So that's the thing. B2C companies, right, like Wonderwall, Wayfair, or TripAdvisor, there's that B2C side, which deal with the end users. So end users could be you, me, anybody on the planet, accessing our services. And the question becomes, and in that case, right, it's very hard because you get millions of users every day showing up, and be able to satisfy their needs is actually very hard to define. But everybody is different. Everybody has their own needs, and even within the area of your business that you're providing a solution for. So I think it's super important from a product aspect to really understand kind of your customer's persona. Define those, be able to interview actual users, you know, understand where they're coming from, you know, validate some of the ideas, but also, you know, I know it's it's a problematic thing to say, but, you know, measure their behavior, right? And then be able to understand, okay, people are getting stuck there. Why don't they move forward that? Why? Because, you know, there is a paywall. Oh, this thing is annoying over there for them, whatever it is. So be able to really have a very data-driven approach, effectively, to better understand our customers, both from a quantitative feedback and qualitative. That's the way we do it.
So would it be fair to say that, kind of to summarize that, you're trying to gather information to be able to determine, you know, if there's a flaw or a path forward or the way you could do something better and then implementing it.
And he's like a problem solver, right?
Exactly. Yeah. I'm an engineer. I'm a technology background. So it's all about problem solving. That's everything. That's all I do. No, that's exactly right. Right. So I do strongly believe in iteration. Right. People say, oh, let's introduce this new thing and do that new things. And sometimes it's fine. That's what you have to do. That's even what the data shows, is that, you know, there is a gap there and, you know, you need to fill the gap. But even when you do that, I strongly believe in iterating towards it, right? You know, baby steps. You know, you take a small step, you validate your approach, you learn from it, take the next step and the next step. Those steps can be very fast, right? They don't have to take forever. But I strongly believe by doing that approach, you end up in a better place than what you're thinking you will be.
Okay, so I got to ask a question. This is in your bio. Can you define extreme leadership?
Sure. So extreme leadership is actually a book. I'm trying to find it here. Well, it's not extreme leadership. It's extreme ownership. It's actually a book that was written a while ago, and it talks about SEALs. So, which is interesting, like this very kind of army-oriented book. But it talks about leadership, your point. But it's all about do everything you can do to own something, right? So instead of, you know, blaming others, instead of saying, oh, something happened. Well, I don't know, Google changed their ICO algorithm and now it works good. Oh, there's nothing I can do about that. It's Google. Right? Then you take action and say, okay, what do I control? What can I do? Right? You know, how can we look at the problem a different way? You know, and ultimately be finding solution, taking actions. You know, even if you feel like it's not fair, or doesn't matter. Right? At the end of the day, you are in charge of what you can control, and you do what you can do to deal with it.
Okay, I mean, that totally makes sense. It's kind of interesting, that term. So,
well, it's because it's ownership, but it's ownership to the extreme. Like, it's really just, because it's not just, oh, what can you do, but, you know, who can you influence? You know, how can you? It's really not just looking at your own bubble, but looking at everything around it as well, and be able to say, okay, what can I do to change things in a positive manner? You know, it could be in your bubble, it could be outside your bubble, and try to find different ways to do that.
All right, so how does somebody get in touch with you?
Best things have been LinkedIn, to be honest.
Okay.
that's the best platform for me. I usually don't, I'm not a big call person, per se, so if you try to call myself, that's going to be a problem, because most likely I won't answer. But if you send me a message on LinkedIn, for example, that's the best way.
All right. Sounds good. Cool. And is there anything else you'd like to tell us?
Yeah, I mean, you touched the topic of extreme ownership. And I think for me, it's all about defining ownership. But to define ownership, first and foremost, you need to define what you want to own. Right. So at a company level, effectively, you have your company owns a bunch of different domains, right? Any company does, right? You know, because domains can be, you know, how to have a product that your users can use, but it can be, you know, HR, it can be your inventory, it can be how to integrate with your vendors. You know, there could be a lot of different domains, right? And depending on your industry and everything. So first, defining your domains, actually, I think is a critical thing to do. Second is really be able to play with your domains in some way, right? You know, understand your domains. And to do that, first, you need to have visibility into them. Right? I talk a lot about data. Right? What kind of data do you know that can tell you how is your domain is doing? And second is effectively to be able to start tweaking things, right? You know, play with things, like fix some issues, you know, add some stuff to see how things react. Then from that, then you can really define that vision, right? You know, business vision, technical vision, domain vision overall, about where you want your domain to be, you know, in 2 years from now, 3 years from now, whatever is your right horizon. And then from that, then you can start, okay, this vision is obviously usually is with a lot of different things, a lot of different areas that needs to be influenced or changed for that domain to change ultimately. So be able to define the strategies, the swim lanes of things that you want to change. And then from there, be able to start roadmapping effectively. Like, you know, don't put dates. There is no point in putting dates, but what are the different steps in each of the swim lanes to get where you want to be? And then start going at it. Like, you know, put a process in place or some kind of cadence or to start executing against them. So that, for me, that's how you translate that entrepreneurship mindset into something at the company level you can execute. Right? It's not just, oh, well, I have this to-do list of 50 things, let me just go at it. No, you have limited capacity, you have limited focus. So how do you make sure that you focus on the right thing at the right time, effectively, so that you can properly own what you're supposed to own? I think for me, that's what's critical here.
Do you find a lot of business leaders lack focus on, you know, that maybe they're just kind of just wanting, reaching in different directions too quickly, mm-hmm. and not focusing on what they really could be good at?
Exactly. That's what I've seen a lot, some of the symptoms of that, right? One symptom that I've seen is that as a result, we're going to hire like hundreds of people to work on different things. Some of them are not barely related to the other thing, but that are barely related to your core domain, I call it, right? Your core area of expertise. So that's one thing, right? If you have the funding, it's very easy to say, oh, we'll just put people on this and put people on that and put people on that. And now you have like 50 different teams doing 50 different things and that are not, don't really well with each other. That's one. The other way is that is the other problem, which is why you have limited capacity. So it's not like you're going to hire thousands of people today, but what you're going to do is that you're going to have a spotlight problem where, you know, 1 month you're going to focus on this one thing and the second month you're going to focus on something else and something else and something else. And then ultimately that doesn't promote ownership either, right? Long-term ownership, because it's kind of you're dealing with something now and you're going to make progress, hopefully. But then, you know, as soon as you take your eyes off of it, then it's going to go downhill like before, right? So be able to, you know, when I promote ownership, I promote long-term ownership, right? Everything that's critical to your business, be able to own it long-term and in a way that, you know, you don't have to, yes, there is always a spotlight. There is always an area of focus or new thing or opportunity for improvement in the area, but how do you make sure you don't drop the ball on the other side, right? And so for me, that's what's good.
I can see such a need for all of this. Well, Arno, thank you so much for joining us today, and a lot of great information. The best to you.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Bill.
Well, it's always great to have a good high-tech problem solver. Well, that's it for this week. Until next week, this is User-Friendly 2.0, keeping you safe on the cutting edge.
User-Friendly 2.0 is copyright 2013 to 2024 by User-Friendly Media Group, Incorporated. All rights reserved. Opinions expressed on the show are those of the hosts and guests and not this radio station. Please check out userfriendly.show for airtimes and podcasts.